All right, the last case of the calendar today is U.S. versus Adams, 21-3043, and we'll hear from Mr. Hansmeier first.
Judge Bacharach, may it please the court. This case is about whether a Kansas aggravated battery conviction qualifies as a crime of violence under 4B1.2A1. We've given the court three reasons why we think it's not a crime of violence. My limited time today, and in light of the, I think, 130 pages of briefing you have, I'm going to try to focus on the first issue, which focuses on the against the person of another requirement in 4B1.2A. I'll start there. We have made a straightforward textual argument on this, and I don't know that any of it is really disputed by the government, so I don't at least in their brief, they don't really dispute any of this. And I don't want to just waste my time regurgitating our textual argument. I mean, I can go through it briefly, but I mean, we think person of another person means someone who is born alive because that's what Congress said in Section 8A. It's also the ordinary meaning of that term. If you look to the things that you would look to for ordinary meaning, dictionary definitions, model penal code, common law, things that this court has looked to in the past to resolve these issues. We talk about the context a lot in our brief. We think that helps us when you look at the guidelines as a whole and how it uses the phrase person of another elsewhere, another person elsewhere. We think the history is on our side too. And if you're still not convinced at the end of the day, we have the rule of lenity, which this court applies frequently in this context. If you think we're something is ambiguous about this. So I don't want to regurgitate all of that. I just want to, I guess, move to the government's counter arguments, the claims that the government has actually put some work into. And on that ground, on those arguments, the alternate grounds, we're going to push back on whether you should consider those claims.
Well, Mr. Hansmeier, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but before you get to the counter arguments, I did want to ask you about part of your threshold arguments, and that is under the Dictionary Act, Section 8. And you do address this in your brief, in your reply brief, but it's about the word includes in 8A. I mean, you know, we typically view that as inclusive, not exhaustive. And there's canons that if you have two or more items, then we look for the similarities. But here there's only one item, and that is born alive in 8A. And it seems a little bit counterintuitive to say that means that a person has to be born alive when it's predicated with the word includes. Tell me, what's your response to that concern?
Right. So I think the word includes, if it precedes an illustrative list of examples, I think that's when you have, this idea that, you can take that word and it may mean something that's not listed. But I think that is unhelpful here because this is not an illustrative list of examples of what a person is. It just says a person, is born alive. And I think if you were to say, well, actually what Congress meant was that person means someone who is born alive and someone who is unborn, you've just destroyed the statute. Like, there's no point of that statute. There's no point in Congress writing that statute if the distinction that is made in the statute is obliterated. And we don't think there is a case that is helpful for the government on that point. The government certainly doesn't find a case where you have this type of language and where a court says, well, it does say this, but we're going to interpret it to mean the opposite. And I think without that case, includes does work, but it can't destroy the statute. So that's, but and again, even if you don't buy the 8A argument, I mean, the ordinary meaning of the term, I don't think the government ever really does really anything to dispute that. And when you plug in, you know, you can plug in the unborn child into the guidelines and you will make hash of the guidelines. It won't make any sense. So for all of those reasons, we think purely, you know, a textual analysis gets us to where we need to get. But turning to the alternate grounds, I want to start with, I guess, divisibility. And obviously, this wasn't raised below, and the government has the burden of proof on this, and it's a heightened burden. It's a burden of certainty. And so really, the government is really, in this case, more than others, is using this court as a second shot forum to raise arguments that it just didn't raise below. And that is a disfavored practice. That's a quote. It is disfavored for this court to consider those type of arguments for the first time. And here, divisibility, we know, involves questions of fact. This court has said so. And that's another reason. And on top of all of that, there is a three-factor test that you have to engage to determine whether you're going to consider an alternate ground, and the government just ignores it. So there is a second level of waiver here, inadequate briefing, that is another reason why you just shouldn't get to these arguments. But, and then we have United States v. Hall, which is a recent case where that's what this court did. It said the government did not raise the divisibility below. We're not considering it on appeal. But even if you disagree with all of that and you want to address divisibility, there is a fundamental problem with the government's argument, and that is it does not focus on elements. It does not ask the relevant question. The relevant question is whether the statute sets forth alternative elements. What the government wants to ask is whether it is about the statute's unit of prosecution. I mean, and we've, you know, Judge Matheson wrote a very helpful concurrence in Rents that we rely on that explains that those things are different. You know, it's true that the unit of prosecution in this context is the person element. It doesn't follow from that that the person element is divisible. Those are two different things. And I think doctrinally, you see from the government's brief that it doesn't even talk about elements. So when we think about an elements inquiry, the ultimate where we end is whether those alternate elements create separate crimes. So the government sort of runs with this idea of a separate crime, right? They sort of ignore the analysis for the conclusion. And they essentially say, well, we can show separate crimes under a unit of prosecution theory, and that's enough. But it's not. I mean, separate elements create separate crimes, but it's not true that separate crimes have separate elements, right? I mean, two crimes punished under the same statute have the same elements. So there's just a fundamental, I think, misunderstanding of the law in the government's brief. And really, that's why the statute is indivisible. Kansas state law, the case the government relies on, State v. Seba, is great for us. It talks about how, you know, there is no limitation to a specific victim. It's clearly, you know, murder includes the killing of an unborn child. This is a statute that expands a definition. It doesn't create a different element. I do want to address the government's legal imagination argument. I think there are serious doctrinal problems with this argument too. You know, the legal imagination test is a test that courts use when a defendant comes into court and says, yeah, I know my prior conviction counts under the law as it's written, but there's this special thing going on in the state or whatever that means it shouldn't count. And I don't know of a case, the government cites no case where this test has been used the way the government wants you to use it in terms of, well, the conviction plainly doesn't count under the plain terms, but we want to sort of backdoor, an analysis that if we can just allege that it would count, if conduct would count, let's focus on conduct, not elements, that we can somehow sweep that into the statute. And O'Connor, O'Connor rejects the argument. This is the same argument that the government made in O'Connor. If you look at pages 1153 on O'Connor, in O'Connor, there's a discussion about how the government says in that case that involved threat to property. It says, look, you cannot just threaten property. That doesn't make any sense. Your threat has to be aimed at a person, right? You don't walk up to a building and say, I'm going to blow you up. You walk up to a person and say, I'm going to blow your building up. And the government says, so inherent in any threat to property is a threat to person. And this court said, no, that's not how it works. What we do is we look at the language of the statute. And because the statute said threats to property count, that argument was rejected. It's no different here. I mean, the statutes are plain. Kansas law, defines person to include the unborn. 4B1.2 does not. On the face of the statute, the government just loses the case. I do want to also address, and on top of that, again, we're talking about a government that has the burden of proof with certainty. Multiple times this court has said, government, you haven't met that heightened burden. But if you do buy into this argument that the government has made and somehow, you write it into law and let the government make it for the first time, I do want to note that it is not at all difficult to imagine one of these crimes. I mean, there are abortion pills that are perfectly safe for women to take. Alcohol causes serious harm to unborn children that, that's not something the woman herself has to worry about. So, I mean, there are ways. I mean, this is not, you don't need legal imagination to imagine how an angry boyfriend would hurt that doesn't want a child and has no intent to harm his girlfriend would be able to harm the fetus. And so we don't think, even if you get beyond the doctrinal problems of the argument, that there's no purchase in what the government says. And with that, I mean, if there are no questions, I know it's been a long day. I'll go ahead and reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hansmeier. Melissa, let's stop Mr. Hansmeier's clock. Judge Bell, do you have any questions?
No, I don't.
Okay. Judge Carson, do you?
I don't. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Carr?
Good morning, Your Honors, or perhaps good afternoon, depending on where you are.
Could you stop just a second? Because I don't know if it's just me, but boy, you come in. It's very hard to understand because it's really staticky. Was that just for
no, me? Judge? No. It's him in general. Mr. Clark, do you have the call-in information available?
Let me try one other thing, and then we'll call in.
Okay. Or do you have like a phone or something that might be too close to the computer or the microphone that might be interfering?
I don't think so. Is this any better?
That's much better.
Yeah, that's great. Much
better.
Oh, okay. Good. Well, thank you, Judge Bachrach, for stopping me.
Just for our technical support people, what did you do to solve what was the problem?
Oh, on my end, Judge?
On the audio, yeah.
I have two options for a microphone. One is through my laptop and the other is through the web camera. So it seems like maybe the microphone on the web camera is having issues.
Oh. Okay.
So I switched them, which hopefully will give better audio than a speakerphone. But I'm Assistant United States Attorney Brian Clark, appearing on behalf of the government. May it please the court. Mr. Adams' prior conviction for Kansas aggravated battery under KSA 21-5413-B1C is a crime of violence that warranted the sentence he received below. This court held as much in Trento Martinez and in Williams, and the government asked the court to affirm his sentence under those precedents. Mr. Adams' two arguments for avoiding this result should be rejected. First, Mr. Adams was not convicted of an offense against an unborn child under KSA 21-5419, which is also known as Alexa's Law and prohibits it prohibits aggravated battery against an unborn child.
Is that right? Does 5419, can anybody be charged and convicted for violating 5419? Seems to me odd because 5419 is a definition term. It's sort of like saying, I'm going to be convicted under the Dictionary Act. Well, the Dictionary Act just defines terms that are elsewhere defined in other criminal provisions. Can somebody be convicted under 5419?
I think a conviction for an aggravated battery against an unborn child would have to be brought under 5419 and also 5413.
Sabo? Was Mr. Sabo convicted under 54? He was convicted on two counts under 5413, right? He was not convicted under 5419. Am I wrong about that?
I don't think that's correct. I have not seen the indictment or the judgment of conviction for Mr. Sabo, but the Kansas Supreme Court said three really important things in Sabo. And the first of which is, I think, a mischaracterization in the reply brief. So the first point is that Mr. Sabo was charged with two counts of first degree murder. And then in the very next sentence, the Kansas Supreme Court stated, one of which was under Alexa's law. So right there, you have the Kansas Supreme Court distinguishing between a conviction that's solely for just sort of a traditional, ordinary first degree murder, as opposed to a first degree murder that is under Alexa's law. Later in that decision, in when it's discussing intent and whether the parties had really addressed the intent that's required to be shown under Alexa's law, it refers to a, quote, Alexa's law offense, again, indicating that it sees the two offenses as being separate. And then if that weren't enough, it also mentions, as Mr. Hansmeier said, that that the Kansas legislature, in enacting Alexa's law, intended to create an additional unit of prosecution for offenses against an unborn child. And I take the point that a unit of prosecution is different than an element. But I think in this context where the court is applying the categorical approach, I don't think really the difference matters all that much. And the reason I think comes out in this court's case in Cantu, which both of the parties cite and rely on in their briefs. In Cantu, this court was presented with a question of whether the defendant's prior conviction of a drug offense under an Oklahoma statute was a categorical match for a controlled substance offense under federal law. The underlying offense under Oklahoma law listed a laundry list of drugs in a list. And the question before the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals in a case that this court relied on was whether that laundry list of drugs created different ways of committing a single offense, or if they created separate offenses, one for each drug.
Did Cantu even talk about Mathis or talk about divisibility?
Yes, it did. In fact, one of the key questions in Cantu was whether the Oklahoma statute was divisible down to the specific drug, or whether it was divisible just to certain categories of drugs. In the specific Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals decision that Cantu relied on, said that the defendant could not be convicted of two drug offenses because he mailed two drugs in a single package. This court in Cantu said that was potent evidence that the underlying Oklahoma statute was not divisible down to the drug. Now, the same analysis applies.
Was in Cantu, was this list of different drugs, was that in the same section that made it illegal, or was it in a separate definitional section?
That is a good question, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure that it makes a difference, though, because I think the same analysis in Cantu applies here, except it points to the opposite conclusion in this case. And that is because in Cantu, this court said that state court's conclusion that a statute could not be charged twice for a single act was potent evidence that it was not divisible. Here we have Kansas versus Sabo, which says that there can be two charges for a single act. And the reason there can be two charges is because of Alexa's law. And so,
well, take Rents. You know, there were two adults that were shot. And so there were two, you know, the reason he's talking, Judge Matheson is talking in his concurrence about two units of prosecution is that there was only one criminal violation, him discharging the weapon, and it went through an individual and hit another individual. So there's two units of prosecution. And so I think what Mr. Hansmeier is saying is, well, in Sabo is that there's two units of prosecution. There are two persons that are, that could be subject to the first degree murder. And obviously, he was convicted of two units of prosecution, but I'm not sure that supports your idea that these are two different that these are elements, not means.
So I think maybe an example would help. So I think that the parties agree that if you were to read the traditional Kansas aggravated battery statute 5413 in conjunction with Alexa's law, you have a Kansas aggravated battery statute with alternatives. The only question then is whether these are alternative means, different ways of committing the same exact crime, or if you have two different crimes or two different versions of the crime, as the court called it in DeCamp. And in DeCamp, what the court said was, if you imagine a situation where there's a hypothetical statute, a hypothetical burglary statute that criminalizes generic burglary as well as burglary of an automobile. And in this hypothetical scenario, those two versions of the statutes are typically, in a typical case, charged differently. In that situation, the Supreme Court in DeCamp said the court would look to see which version of the law the defendant had been charged with. Here, I think it's the same thing. There are alternatives. The question for the court is whether the alternative is an alternative way of committing the same crime, or it's an alternative version of Kansas aggravated battery that would be charged differently. And for the three reasons, those three indications in SEBA, we think it's pretty clear that in a typical case, a defendant who is convicted of an offense against an unborn child would be charged under Alexa's law for what the Supreme Court said was an Alexa's law violation. Here, if you look at the judgment of conviction, it states that Mr. Adams was convicted of violating KSA 215413B, and that's it. There's no mention of Alexa's law, no mention of 5419, no mention of an unborn child victim. And in this situation, it makes Mr. Adams no different than Mr. Trejo Martinez or Williams. And
nobody get a clarification. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I didn't.
You go ahead.
Well, yeah. Did I understand you to say that the judgment that was actually entered, the verdict in this case that was actually entered, was for 215413B?
That is correct.
And not 2415C. And there was no, it wasn't just generally 215413.
Correct. It was the judgment states that the statute of conviction was 21-5413B. And that's on page 34 of volume one of the record.
But why does that matter when both B and C use another person? And then 5419, does define what is meant by another person in A and B as including an unborn child.
That's correct. And our view is that because of the nature of Alexa's law, it's not a pure definitional provision, just a traditional one where you would just simply incorporate the new definition into the underlying offense. And again, even if you were to do that, I would go back to my previous argument that actually it would then just create two versions of the law, and then you'd have to look and see which version Mr. Adams was convicted of. It was not Alexa's law. It was the traditional version, therefore crime of violence. But I think our statutory arguments are particularly relevant here, because it's the exceptions to Alexa's law that create sort of an awkward fit, because the exceptions state that the Alexa's law does not apply in certain circumstances. And there are three situations where Alexa's law simply doesn't apply at all. That is where the conduct involves the actions of a mother of the unborn child, or the actions of a physician performing an authorized medical procedure, or the dispensation of authorized prescription drugs. I think these exceptions actually cover each of the scenarios that Mr. Hansmeier mentioned in his opening part of the argument, where the statute simply wouldn't apply. So if you're applying just a pure categorical approach and you're not looking at the facts at all, there's no way of even knowing whether Alexa's law even applied in a particular case. It necessarily requires the court to sort of look behind the statute to determine what the defendant was actually convicted of, which version of the law. And here, I think, you know, there's no dispute that Mr. Adams was not convicted of an offense against an unborn child. And if the court reaches the divisibility question, it should conclude that based on the judgment of conviction, that he was convicted of ordinary Kansas aggravated battery, which this court has already held.
I don't know that the test is whether he was in fact convicted of death of an unborn child or not. I think the test, unless if it is just a test of the language of the statute itself rather than as applied, I think the test is, could that statute have been invoked by the death of a fetus?
Right. I think that's correct. And when I say whether he was convicted of an offense against an unborn child, I'm talking about whether the statute that he was convicted of violating actually covers that offense. I'm not talking
We're not talking about him at all. So we just need to keep it straight. Yeah.
I'm not talking about what Mr. Adams actually did to get convicted. I'm saying what the statute that he was convicted of violating actually says.
I am having difficulty understanding why you think he could not have been convicted of death of an unborn child when 2154.19 says, as used in 5413B, person also means unborn.
So our response is twofold. The first is, we think under SEBA, the Kansas Supreme Court has indicated that a conviction under Alexa's law would typically be charged that way. That is why the court distinguished between the two charges in that case. And then the second point would simply be that the definitions in 5419, which is Alexa's law, do not automatically apply in every case. So for example, instead of Mr. Adams, say it was a woman who is capable of, you know, burying a child, and she would have a defense in that case, you know, in the underlying criminal case, that Alexa's law didn't apply to her at all. And so there is a question, just looking at it categorically, whether 5419 even applies in any case, which requires, would require the court to sort of look behind the statute at what the actual statute of conviction was. I see my time is up. If there are no further questions, I would just ask the court to affirm.
Judge Abell, do you have any additional questions?
No.
Judge Carson, do you?
No, thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Hansmeier, you have some rebuttal.
Let me just make five quick points on SEBA and the language the government relies on. Look, there were two crimes that were charged. And the shorthand for the court referring to those crimes does not mean that the crimes have separate elements. It's just shorthand, so anyone reading the opinion could understand it. On Cantu, I mean, I understand both parties cite Cantu, but this is a new argument. The government has never argued that somehow Cantu adopts a unit of prosecution measurement instead of an alternative elements measurement. And I don't think it does. If it did, the government should have said that in its brief. It should have at least cited it for that proposition. And as far as I'm aware, there's no case that looks to unit of the prosecution to determine elements. On the definitional statutes, this idea that, well, we can look to the judgment and the charging document, and then a 5419B, that statute isn't cited. Well, it's not an unborn child. I mean, the government has the burden of proof. It has not shown at all that in Kansas, definitional statutes are included in charging documents or judgments. There is another definitional statute here, 5111T, that defines person. I mean, I don't know of a Kansas indictment or a Kansas judgment that includes 5111T in it. And if that doesn't exist, the government hasn't shown it exists, why would there be an indictment or a charging document that includes a different definitional provision, 5419? It's the government's burden of proof to do all of these things. This is, again, the government didn't do anything do with this because it didn't raise the argument below. Fourth point, just on these exceptions in the definition, there is no precedent at all. Again, the government's burden of proof, no precedent at all that the government cites to show that these exceptions somehow transform a definitional provision into an element of offense. If that's true, the government should have proved it. My last, look, this distinction between a means and an element, the government just doesn't understand. This is an overarching person element, and it can be, you know, charged and convicted regardless of whether the victim is born or unborn. It is a classic umbrella term that Kansas has expanded to include other things. So yes, that's why maybe we don't see 5419, because it doesn't have to be there. It's just a means. It's not an element. And with that, I will cede my 17 seconds. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hansmeyer. Judge Abell, do you have anything else?
Nope.
All right, Judge Carson, do you?
I don't. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. This matter will be submitted.